Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast sponsored by the American Centrum in Hamburg. Today, we'll be discussing organized crime in Chicago, from Al Capone to the Vice Lords. I'm your host, Andrew Sola. Organized crime is a complex topic, and who better to help us understand it than our two experts today, Professor Joe Kraus and Professor Robert M. Lombardo. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Robert Lombardo is Emeritus Professor in the Department of Criminology and Criminal Justice at Loyola University Chicago. He is a 33-year police veteran and has worked in all areas of policing, including patrol, investigations, narcotics, and organized crime. He is the author of Organized Crime in Chicago, Beyond the Mafia, and The Black Hand, Terror by Letter in Chicago, both published by the University of Illinois Press. Joe Kraus is professor of English and theater at the University of Scranton. He is a historian of Jewish gangster lore and the former president of the Society for the Study of Multi-Ethnic Literature in the U.S. He is the author of The Kosher Capones, A History of Chicago's Jewish Gangsters. I'm going to give a short introduction in a moment, but first, Robert, can you provide something like a technical definition of organized crime? What is it and what is it not?
Well, the term organized crime covers a number of different crimes, so to speak. But our concern here is what's known as traditional organized crime. We're not talking about three people committing a burglary and fencing the material. That's organized. There's three people committing the crime. We're talking about traditional organized crime, which is defined by the fact that there's political corruption. Traditional organized crime in American society has always been tightly integrated into big city political machines.
Okay, so we're not talking about any sorts of street crime at this point. And just quickly, what about, say, more modern types of street gangs? In what sense are they organized or not?
Well, they certainly are organized, but again, that's why the term traditional organized crime developed. The street gangs take, for example, Chicago, the Vice Lords, the Gangster Disciples, the Latin Kings, very involved in criminality, particularly the drug trade, but they do not have political protection or not integrated into the big city political machines. That's the key difference. They are a different animal.
Right. So as I was saying, Robert's definition was excellent because it really puts the focus on our discussion today, which is the various type of specific traditional organized crime, which we know from the movies that was practiced in Chicago 100 years ago. But I just think we need to start before Prohibition. And what I'd like to do is tell the story of Chicago from 1870, when it started really booming, until 1920, which was when Prohibition started. So in previous episodes, we learned a lot about the different immigration patterns to Chicago from 1870 through 1920. And we discussed how the city was the fastest growing city on the planet during those years, as wave upon wave of German, Irish, Italian, Polish, Lithuanian, Ukrainian, Czech, Black, and Jewish people arrived. For all of these groups, drinking alcohol was a significant part of their cultural identity. We also learned that Chicago's population doubled in size every 10 years in that period, going from 300,000 people in 1870 to nearly 3 million people in 1920. I did the math on this. So every day for 50 years, on average, 130 new immigrants arrived. 130 new immigrants arrived every day. This means that every day the city had to build housing for 130 new people, sewers, kitchens, water faucets, toilets for 130 new people. Just look out your window and imagine a new apartment building that fits 130 people appearing there tomorrow, just overnight. And now imagine another one fitting another 130 people appearing the next day. And then imagine in a week, there'll be 7 new buildings. It's a whole new neighborhood, 1,000 new people. And multiply that by 50 years. Along with the new housing, the city had to build streets to move the people, restaurants to feed them, schools to educate them, and hospitals to treat them. Brand new services every day for 130 new people. And these new arrivals needed to be governed. So new political districts had to be created with new political positions. And those positions needed to be filled with new officials. And America is a democracy, so the new arrivals voted in elections so they could be governed by representatives that they chose for themselves. Government by the people, for the people. And these new arrivals sometimes broke the law. So new police stations, new courts, and new jails were built to accommodate the new criminals arriving every day. And some of those policemen and judges who dispensed justice were appointed by the new politicians who were elected by the new arrivals themselves. And sometimes those newly elected politicians were criminals, and they appointed their cronies to be policemen and judges. In the previous episode, we discussed Upton Sinclair's famous Chicago novel, The Jungle, which is written in 1906. And he has a one-page description of the city that I'm going to read out now. Apologies for its length. It's much more beautiful than what I could describe, and it really tells us what Chicago looked like in 1906. So the main character in The Jungle is Jurgis. So Jurgis got a glimpse of the high-class criminal world of Chicago. The city, which was owned by an oligarchy of businessmen, being nominally ruled by the people, a huge army of graft was necessary for the purpose of effecting the transfer of power. Twice a year, in the spring and fall, elections. Millions of dollars were furnished by the businessmen and expended by this army. Meetings were held, and clever speakers were hired, bands played, and rockets sizzled. Tons of documents and reservoirs of drinks were distributed, and tens of thousands of votes were bought for cash. And this army of graft had, of course, to be maintained the year round. The leaders and organizers were maintained by the businessmen directly. Aldermen and legislators by means of bribes, party officials out of the campaign funds, lobbyists and corporation lawyers in the form of salaries, contractors by means of jobs, labor union leaders by subsidies, and newspaper proprietors and editors by advertisements. There was the police department and the fire and water departments and the whole balance of the civil list, from the meanest office boy to the head of a city department. And for the horde who could find no room in these, there was the world of vice and crime. There was license to seduce, to swindle, and plunder and prey. The law forbade Sunday drinking, and this had delivered the saloon keepers into the hands of the police and made an alliance between them necessary. The law forbade prostitution, and this had brought the madames into the combination. It was the same with the gambling housekeeper and the pool room man, and the same with any other man or woman who had a means of getting graft and was willing to pay over a share of it. The green goods man and the highwayman, the pickpocket and the sneak thief, and the receiver of stolen goods, the seller of adulterated milk, of stale fruit and diseased meat, the proprietor of unsanitary tenements, the fake doctor and the usurer, the beggar and the pushcart man, the prize fighter and the professional slugger, the racetrack tout, the producer, the white slave agent, and the expert seducer of young girls. All of these agencies of corruption were banded together and leagued in blood brotherhood with the politician and the police. More often than not, they were one and the same person. The police captain who owned the brothel he pretended to raid, and the politician would open his headquarters and his own saloon. So that is the wonderful portion of the city painted by Upton St. Clair in 1906. I apologize for its length. But yeah, let's start with you, Joe. How would you like to tell the story of organized crime before Prohibition in the pre-1920 world of Chicago?
Yeah, well, I'd start by acknowledging Robert's definition of organized crime in general, which I think is a terrific academic description, and I defer to it. The one sort of thing from my own lens is I'm always struck by the fact that organized crime, as it developed in Chicago, tended to have an ethnic component, that it tended to grow out of certain neighborhood constituencies that were coincidentally, or not entirely coincidentally, defined also by ethnicity. So for me, I think it's pretty standard telling is that in the wake of the Chicago fire, you had a guy named Mike McDonald who emerges as the sort of first boss of gambling in this city, as you described, as Sinclair described, that's being reborn Phoenix style from nothing. So you had very quickly in the rebirth of the city an organized effort to control gambling and make it pay, make it into an actual kind of ongoing business in the sense of organized crime. Before long, within the next generation, you have a problem in that you've got these powerful people who are developing economic power through gambling, but they're casting Chicago in a negative light. You know, I think you've spoken about If Christ Came to Chicago, the famous book condemning the city for all of its evils. So you wound up with a kind of interesting negotiation under a father and son set of mayors named Carter Harrison, Carter Harrison Sr., Carter Harrison Jr., that what emerged was essentially a sense that vice in the city could prosper provided it remained segregated in the first ward area of the levee. And by the time you get to pre-prohibition in the early teens and 20s, that seems to me the setting, that you have an agreement that Chicago, which has this important industry of vice, will keep it hidden and secured from everything else so that the propriety, the people who are the powers that be, the face of Chicago to the world, can have their own hands clean. And you get this increasing tension, but for a time it really is a very satisfactory solution for, at least within politics, for a full generation, that the people in the First Ward will run their own business, they'll commit crime, no one else will pay attention to it.
Robert, why don't you add to Joe's description there, please?
Yes, to build on what he said, I'd also like to remind people that Chicago was essentially the center point of the country, and it was the gateway to the unsettled lands of the West. So everybody that was heading out to anywhere west of the Mississippi probably had to come through Chicago. They'd come down from New York through the Erie Canal, sail through the Great Lakes, end up in Chicago. From here, they could go down the river to St. Louis, get on a wagon train, and go further west. So you had essentially hundreds or thousands of single men coming through here at a regular pace. So they needed entertainment, so to speak. So the vice district, the levee, saloons, et cetera, even before the levee properly was established, just saloons in the downtown area provided a place for single men to go spend their last night or two in quote-unquote civilization before they head out to settle the unsettled lands of the West. So that was another dimension to it, the sheer volume of people that came through here looking for some form of entertainment as they passed through. And that certainly contributed to vice activities. And early on, quite early on, the vice activities were tied to political organizations. Prostitution and gambling apparently was always illegal, so the vice entrepreneurs had to pay the police, had to pay the politicians, had to pay someone, and it quickly became organized. So we talk about this is organized crime providing these illegal vice activities, but interestingly enough, at this period of time, there wasn't an Italian among them. This was more or less ran by the Irish politicians or the Irish immigrants and other ethnic groups that were affiliated with the Chicago machine. So the precursor to the mob as we have come to know it, the outfit, the syndicate, what have you, really started in the levy district or in vice areas or amongst the politicians that granted the license to provide vice activities.
Joe, did you want to add something?
Yes, I would say that the levy is, as you pointed out, Robert, it's the names we see emerging as leading figures do tend to be Irish. Not that I'm proud of it. Many of them are also Jewish. The particular politicians who are just so colorful that you almost have to mention them, the aldermen who represented the First Ward were Bathhouse John Coughlin, who, among other things, was an amateur opera singer, and Hinky Dink Kenna, who was a small, quiet guy. And the two of them are kind of they figure in Chicago politics from the 1870s into the 1920s. It's an incredibly long run. By the end, they're actually sort of subordinate figures within the syndicate, almost laughable throwbacks. But so as Robert, you say, I think really eloquently, this is the community that was taking place. When we're looking just at the levy in particular, what you have then are Irish politicians who are fronting for a kind of melting pot experience of crime, largely at that point, gambling and prostitution. Alcohol is still legal, so that's not a particular issue. But it's this sort of wonderful and colorful, ugly kinds of experience. I know the Bucket of Blood is one of the names of one of the gambling joints or the drinking joints. You had, among other things, a guy named Ike Bloom, who was a guy I've done some research into, who was the kind of accountant/functionary of Kenna and Coughlin. And among his other really colorful exploits was he wanted to flaunt the fact that he was making money off prostitutions. He would actually lead marches of his prostitutes through the city at times to sort of almost, I picture them like in parades waving at the crowds. So this sense that, this double sense that Chicago, for all its propriety, also sits atop this tumult of vice and color.
Yeah, both of the people you mentioned there, Joe, also appear in Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. And since you mentioned both of their names, here's just a really short passage of a judge by the name of Growler Pat Callahan. This is much shorter than the previous one, but it's funny, so I'll read it. So the main character, Jurgis, goes to court for the first time for punching his boss at the meatpacking plant. So he's hauled before the judge, and this is the description of the judge. Growler Pat had begun his life as a butcher boy and a bruiser of local reputation. He had gone into politics almost as soon as he had learned to talk and held two offices at once before he was even old enough to vote. But Growler Pat had given up holding city offices early in his career, caring only for party power and giving the rest of his time to superintending his dives and brothels. Of late years, however, since his children were growing up, he had become to value respectability and had himself made magistrate by himself, a position for which he was admirably fitted because of his strong conservatism and contempt for foreigners. I mean, that's a funny passage for a number of reasons. It's all true. But we've spoken in previous episodes about the split between old immigrants, as it were, established immigrants, and the new ones. And in the Jewish Chicago episode, there was the split between the more middle or upper class Jewish old arrivals, as it were, and the masses of new Jewish immigrants arriving. And I think that worked with the other ethnic groups too. So even if you had only immigrated 20 years before everyone else, somehow you were naturally bored and you had contempt for all of these new foreigners arriving. I think that's funny. Robert?
Well, I'm not surprised. We experienced that today. It seems that the people that came first become established. They feel somewhat of superiority. And then you have another group coming along trying to work their way up. And obviously they have less education. They're taking their turn in the barrel, so to speak. It's a multi-generational process. And those that have made it apparently seem often to resent or not really want to mingle with their lessers, so to speak.
Yeah. And speaking of different types and generations of immigrants, you wrote a book on the first generation of Italian criminals, the Black Hand. So the Black Hand was operating before Prohibition. Can you just describe who the Black Hand were and what they were doing in Chicago?
Well, the Black Hand was not a group. It wasn't a person. I mean, it was a method of crime. Anybody could be a Black Hand offender. I've identified Jewish offenders, Polish offenders. All you have to do is get a pencil and a pen and paper, write a threatening letter to somebody you think had money, a little stamp of the hand of the Black Hand on the paper or other evil symbols, and the notoriety about Black Hand crime that was generated by the newspapers really caused a certain amount of fear amongst the people that received those letters. And all it took was a little violence to convince people to pay. Typically, the victims were those within an ethnic community that were successful. You opened a corner store, you might have had the corner saloon. Granted, a lot of it happened more in Sicilian neighborhoods than just generally Italian neighborhoods. But again, it was a method of crime and not a criminal organization. There's evidence Italians in Chicago were returning to Italy to find protection from Black Hand extortion, which allegedly did not occur in Italy or in Sicily. It was an American phenomena that originated on the East Coast, and it was picked up by other communities. Some of the most famous offenders, when you really get into who they were very young people, like gangbangers, you know, 19 years old, 21 years old. They weren't sophisticated, quote unquote, mustache Pete's or these Sicilian immigrant mafia people from Sicily. In fact, I'm firmly convinced that the mafia never left Italy or left the south of Italy or Sicily. You may have had individual or particular individual criminals that had been a criminal in Italy, but as an organization, it was never transplanted here based upon my own research. So the Black Hand was a method of crime. It wasn't a group.
And nor was it organized crime in our traditional definition.
Yes, they did not get political protection, so to speak.
Joe, can you describe the state of, I mean, in the Jewish community before Prohibition, would you describe there being organized crime in the traditional sense, or are we thinking that these were just street gangs?
I think it probably falls somewhere in between. There certainly were street gangs within the Jewish community, but maybe less so, less dramatically. Frederick Thrasher has an extensive study about the gang in Chicago, and his proposal there is that Jewish gangs tended to be less violent than other particular gangs. But I think in terms of organized crime, what you see in the Levy district that we've been talking about a little bit are businesses that do emerge that are necessary for some kind of a financial ecosystem for organized crime. So you have gambling, of course, and many Jews are involved in that, as is just about everybody. You have prostitution, and I'm always sad to report Jews were disproportionately represented in all of that. And you have fences were very crucial parts of this, because if you had organized burglary across the city, people had to have something they could do with their goods. And Jews were also disproportionately represented with that. So it's not organized crime in the sense that we're going to conceive of it as soon as Prohibition begins, because that's dramatic. Not just it opens up a brand new dimension of organized crime in terms of illegal alcohol, but in Chicago more than anywhere else, it produces this absolute windfall of resources that empower the gangsters in dramatic ways. I heard someone once describe the transition as being before Prohibition, gangsters were subject to the authority of the politicians. After Prohibition, that was reversed because of the powerful economic force of illegal income from booze. So I hope that's an answer to your question, that it's not mere street gang, but it's not the full-blown organized crime that Robert defined so eloquently.
That's a perfect answer because it allows me to segue into the Prohibition, which I was channeling my inner Rod Blagojevich. And I was like, Prohibition was a fucking golden goose for the people who realized quickly what could be done now that alcohol is banned. As you said, it basically put organized crime on steroids. So I read somewhere that the first, it only took 1 hour after midnight on the 17th of January, 1920, for the first arrest to be made. I'm sorry, for the first theft of alcohol to happen, that was reported. Something like 1,000 crates of medicinal, so-called medicinal whiskey was stolen within like an hour of prohibition going into effect in Chicago, of course.
Andrew, if I could interview very quickly, it was allegedly was perpetrated by my great uncle Hershey Miller, supposedly the architect of that theft. So
that is wonderful. Lovely to have a personal connection here, Joe. All right, so let's just focus then on exactly how this happens. So prohibition comes into effect. We've had this landscape of organized crime. We have the prostitution. We have the gambling. We have racketeering, We have racketeering, which we haven't really discussed yet. So why don't we start first with you, Robert? Take us to the day after the 17th of January, 1920.
Well, you had various gangs throughout the city, typically divided by neighborhood, ethnic neighborhood, so to speak. You had Jewish gangs, you had Irish gangs, you had Italian gangs. And some were more sophisticated and more involved in providing vice, and some were just simply burglary gangs, thieves, what have you. But again, prohibition provided the opportunity to now you have, like you said, this golden goose. You have a product that everybody wants, but they cannot obtain legally. And in many ways, your average person thought the law was probably ridiculous. How can you outlaw? The majority of people weren't against this. It was just a certain reform element that wanted to outlaw alcohol. So a ready-made racket developed essentially overnight. And the Roaring Twenties resulted in the fact that everybody wanted to make money, so they started fighting over territories. There was plenty of money to go around, but people got selfish. People wanted to control it all, essentially. So what happened, you had a war typically between the Italian groups. Even some of the Italians fought each other and the Irish, and there was some other like the Southeast McFarland gang. They were probably more Eastern European. Everybody more or less tried to provide, these criminal groups tried to provide alcohol within their own areas. And competition developed. Just like today, you have a competition through the major beer distributors. You had a competition then between all the various vice entrepreneurs and those that provided liquor. And the end result, as we came to know it, were the beer wars that resulted in the eventual evolution, so to speak, of this crime syndicate in Chicago, as these other groups more or less were filtered out, so to speak, or forced out, and the Capone syndicate became dominant. It didn't happen overnight. It took quite a long time, but in fact, they did. Why? Why did they win? Maybe there were more Italians at that period, because it was their turn for large-scale immigration. Maybe they had more guns. Maybe they were more violent. Maybe they controlled more politicians. But for whatever reason, they were the ones that more or less took over bootlegging in Chicago and many other parts of the country.
Joe, you've had a slightly different take on this. I know you were speaking in the previous episode that you considered the outfit to have a confederation model that was not Italian-based and that they were pretty welcoming to, for example, the Jewish element of organized crime.
If I can interject, that they allowed anybody in that would more or less do what they were told or would cooperate. The other interesting thing that nobody knows is that most of Capone's gangsters were not Italian. So this was not an Italian thing. It was more or less the Capone group, their corporation, or whatever you want to call it, they wanted to be dominant. Anybody was invited to participate, more or less, that did what they were told.
I would tell that story just a little more slowly, but to the same effect. I do think we'd have this notion of radical, crazy competition, but I think that period lasted only very briefly, right? This idea, I always think about when the personal computer business started happening. For a very brief moment, everybody was, there were dozens and dozens of people making computers, but rapidly that consolidated into a handful of mid-sized competitors. Of course, when it comes to the gangster world, you don't just put your opponent out of business, you kill them or you destroy them or you drive them away. So for a brief while, I think in the first 6-7 months, anybody with a gun and a truck had a shot at making a lot of money. But pretty quickly it became clear that as long as you said, this is my turf, I got it, you were good. And people who had a certain sufficient amount of influence, of power, money, of human resources, weaponry, were able to say, no, this is where we control. This is our space. And you have pretty quickly an emergence of a map in the city that there certain gangs have responsibility for certain areas. And that's what I call the Confederacy period. And you can even see that some of these maps are literally printed in the newspaper. As Robert says, though, they do collide fairly quickly, right? So you have this sense that the real enemy is anybody who's trying to take a piece of the action that doesn't already have one. But gradually, people start trying to take up more and more space from the groups that they're allegedly in league with. So the initial way this takes place is out of the levee, a man named Big Jim Colosimo, who gets his money originally through prostitution, has the largest gang in the levee. And he and his followers, mostly his followers by legend, suggest, hey, there's a lot of money in booze. And he's working on having a certain propriety image. He actually marries an opera singer. He tries to go around presenting himself as a well-educated, again, proper man. And the people who work with him, including someone who's supposed to be his nephew, a guy named Johnny Torrio, say, there's a whole lot of money here. There's a whole lot of money. He resists. Colosimo is killed. Some people say by a young Al Capone. No one knows for sure. Torrio emerges as the leader of this organization, and it's Torrio who most famously negotiates what amount to the boundaries of these various competing organizations. That holds only for a while, though. As the industry gets more and more mature, other elements within that confederacy become less and less comfortable, and particularly it's the Northside Gang, which is, I always describe them as ecumenical. They're often called the Irish Gang, but in fact, there aren't that many prominent Irish people in it. Dean O'Banion is. His successor, Bugs Moran, is actually French-Canadian. There are quite a few Jews on the north side, Italians on the north side, Poles on the north side. But those two gangs come into conflict with each other. And it's the Torrio Capone gang does eventually emerge as in control, but they don't do it alone. They do it in an alliance with all these other gangs that are there. So that's how I would come to the same conclusion that Robert does, that the Torrio, then eventually the Capone organization, is welcoming of everybody who wants to be a part of it, because the gang that's at the heart of it has found a way to integrate and ally with these other ethnic gangs controlling other parts of the city.
All right. So what I want to do is maybe just dig a little bit deeper into how then the outfit in Chicago built on the substructure that had been created pre-prohibition. So I already read from the jungle that many of the policemen were appointed by politicians. The judges were appointed by politicians. Some of them were bought by the big businessmen in Chicago. So there's this interconnection between, already this interconnection between vice, crime, and the police, and the justice system, and politicians. So how is this put on steroids, as it were, in Prohibition? What is like Al Capone doing that hadn't been already done?
Making money, far, far more money than anybody had made a lot earlier because of Prohibition. And, you know, I like to make a comment. You talk about the outfit. The syndicate, or the Capone syndicate, didn't become the outfit until 1950. And at which period of time the name more or less changed, so to speak, and also did the rules. It wasn't until that time that you had to be Italian to be part of it. After Prohibition, they just didn't need that many criminals. as more or less the size of their activity shrunk, so to speak. So they did restrict it to Italians, and that's when the street crews developed, the five crews, the five sections of the outfit of organized crime in Chicago. And the other really critical part of the whole transition was Mayor Kelly, the Kelly administration. He was probably the most corrupt, but he was also the one that essentially gave the franchise to the syndicate slash outfit to control vice activities post-prohibition, you know, within the city of Chicago. Things had to go through them. One envelope went to City Hall as opposed to everybody making a separate deal. Now, I'm sure local ward committeemen and what have you probably made some money, but it was organized. There was a flow. There was a reason for everything, so to speak. It was to get the vote out, to make sure everybody voted early and voted often and were able to deliver the Democratic vote, whether it was locally or nationally. And Joe talks a lot about that in his book and how well Lawndale was organized. And some of the most famous politicians in Chicago history came out of Lawndale. And that's all because of their power, their political power in developing the vote and delivering it. So Kelly played a big role, and there was a critical evolution, so to speak, during that period of time within organized crime in Chicago.
You raised so many issues there. I just want to kind of put a pin in some of the separate ones. Just first, the technical point. What year did Prohibition end? I forgot.
1929. Oh, 31. Excuse me.
So, I mean, 11 years isn't that so long, 10, 11 years. And you've already started bringing up the post-Prohibition transformation of the mafia then into the outfit. And I want to get to that in a second. But I think the most interesting thing you said is basically you described this as the Prohibition as like any of the major industries in Chicago, like garment working or meatpacking. There was so much money coming in, they needed criminals, but let's just call them employees, to distribute as you would distribute clothing or anything to anyone. And as soon as that it no longer is illegal, those petty criminals who are just, say, distributing liquor to people probably just get jobs being legal liquor distributors. Would that be accurate?
You know, I would... The truck driver that delivered it, I kind of wouldn't even consider them part of organized crime. They were just truck drivers. They were employees. They weren't mob guys. Those that were the supervisors of all this, those that went into a bar and says, you should buy our booze. But laborers, I wouldn't really consider part of the syndicate, so to speak.
Joe?
Yeah, I would add just we can see this evolution, even what we call these groups, right? It's the Capone gang, and then we think about what we call the syndicate, which is really that's the way we label the Capone gang in alliance with so many of the other groups across the city, and that syndicate gradually consolidates. As Robert says, 1950 seems like a really pivotal year. The syndicate consolidates into what we call the outfit, and in doing so, as you said, sheds people along the way. I think its activities tended to be just as broad. They were just better organized. It's an ever more efficient process, so you can get rid of more and more people. So part of what happens as the syndicate evolves into the outfit is that these gangs that were in alliance are no longer necessary. And you have a series in my book, I talk about the killing of Zookie the Bookie, who was a big boss out on the west side. You have they're Italian gangsters in neighborhoods outside of that area who are killed. You have African American politicians and figures who are killed to bring into the fold the very lucrative, in Chicago they call it policy, elsewhere they call it the numbers racket. So you have a whole series of really clinical executions that take place in the late 40s, early 50s that I think mark this transition from syndicate to outfit in a more efficient professional form of organized crime.
We're moving from the Prohibition era to then with the World War II period and then the post-World War II period. I just have a factual question that came from a listener that of this podcast that I was talking to. She was wondering, she'd read a lot of stories that in World War II, one way that various Italian mobsters were able to get the federal government off their back was by assisting the Allied war effort in Sicily and Italy. Are those just rumors, or have you read anything about that, Robert?
Yeah, New York, allegedly, but I think it was a scam. You know, many people have reviewed the whole situation and think it was a scam just to get favored treatment. Joe, you'll probably remember who the high level New York gangster that went to prison, but then claimed to cooperate with the War Department. And then when he got out, he actually went over to Italy and met with some people, but more or less to help the invasion of Sicily. He would made some arrangement with quote unquote local mafia people, but those that have evaluated or reviewed the whole thing think it wasn't as effective as he led the government to believe.
Yeah, I think the big name is Luciano.
Yeah, it was Luciano.
But yeah, there was a smaller guy named Joey Sox Lanza who supposedly had control of particular docks. There was an incident of pretty serious sabotage. A U.S. ship was blown up in harbor. And supposedly the government reached out to Italian organized crime in New York. Right. I don't think this is really true in Chicago. Supposedly, and I've heard a little more credibility than you suggest, Robert, but I approach it with the same fundamental skepticism. So Lanza supposedly said, I can take care of my dock, but if you want anything done, you better talk to Luciano. And whether Luciano was effective or not, we don't know. But it is true that Luciano, who'd been serving a quite lengthy sentence for drug selling in the United States, was permitted to go to Italy afterwards. So it's clear whatever the government thought they were getting, whether they got anything valid or not, they were able to give Luciano what he wanted, which was essentially his freedom. So he was allowed to leave prison.
But this isn't a Chicago issue anyway, it sounds like. You both agree on that.
I'm not aware of anything in yeah.
Well, there was some members of the 42 gang that were released from prison to serve in the military. The government did have that program. And I know for a fact about the 42, and I imagine the program probably existed in New York as well.
Can you tell us a little bit about the 42 gang?
Yeah, I mean, they're essentially local guys on Taylor Street, the Near West Side. They're a juvenile gang. But as time went on, some of them became more and more involved in criminal activity. And the interesting part, again, approaching the 50s, when the street crews were developed, the various factions of the mob, ex-42 gang members that had been adolescent, teenager, gangbanger types, and now adult criminals, what have you, were actually recruited and became part of the Taylor Street crew of the outfit. Now, we know a little bit about the Near North Side and the old Little Sicily, because he had a North Side, was one of the crews, the North Side crew. There was a Gloriana gang there. Some of them allegedly were recruited to form the North Side crew. Now, that I've tried to, you know, find similar incidents, like Grand Avenue was another, Grand and Ogden was another street crew neighborhood. Never really identified a gang there. There's some talk of a gang out in Bridgeport that may have provided some recruits for the Chinatown crew, as it was called, but I never really been able to put my finger on that. But the 42s were the big one. They were active in Prohibition, essentially the young people as drivers, delivery people. And as they matured into adult and the mob itself matured and formed these different crews, they became the basis of the Taylor Street crew, which became probably the largest outfit street crew. Not the most powerful. That would remain what they called Chinatown, which was essentially the non-Chinese part of Bridgeport. Because they were the most powerful crew, because that's where the mayors came from, and they had a lot of political influence, and they delivered the vote in that particular ward early on. So back to the machine politics, critical even at that 1950 stage of the reformation of the mob.
Yeah, so you're saying that the connection between, you already mentioned with Mayor Kelly, the connection between the Italian organized crime and City Hall was still pretty strong up until about what year, would you say? And please don't say the present.
Well, I think they're pretty much long gone, but all the way up until modern times, you know, family secrets, trial, and there was some similar racketeering cases that period of time, let's say the 80s, late 80s, they pretty much spelled the end of the mob as we know it. Now, they claim to have a crew on Grand and Ogden over there, and I actually grew up with one of these guys, and I've talked to several acquaintances of theirs, and there's even a map out there on the internet. You can find 10 gangsters on the Grand Avenue crew. I don't know what they do, what kind of gangsters they could be. Maybe it's nostalgia, but it's my understanding, if where I sit, it's over.
I wanted to kind of give you an opportunity, Robert, based on what you've hinted at several times here, to just draw the connections for the audience, because one of your main theses for all of the work you do is that the common perception of Italians and the outfit or the mob or whatever you want to call it is inaccurate. And you've already touched at some things like the Black Hand was not some sort of organized crime.
Was not the Black Hand.
Was not the Black Hand. And some other things too. So do you just want to take a couple minutes to spell out your thesis?
Well, essentially, organized crime existed. If we subscribe to the definition that it was politics involved with criminal activity, as our history has shown, it existed before Italians. It was run by the Irish, so to speak, and anybody else that was involved in the Levy District was involved in the establishment of Chicago. Think about, you know, like the 1850 and 60 and 70s that we've talked about. Much of Chicago might have been like a cowboy movie on television. You went into the corner saloon and you saw Miss Kitty and the bartender, and there was a roulette wheel and there was a card game. But early on, the politicians here decided to tax that, essentially make money. It was technically illegal, so they took the graft. And that was your basis of the organized crime. It was the machine itself. And as the machine became more and more sophisticated, so did their ability to take graft payments from organized criminal activities. And again, that the seed of prohibition took neighborhood gangs and turned them into citywide criminal syndicates and enterprises. But the city didn't stop taking graft. They went along with it, city officials. And not to pick on the Democrats, but Chicago's always been a Democratic town, except for that one period of time when we had a Republican mayor back in the 20s and 30s. But it's all how it's always worked right up until fairly modern times. We've probably saw the end of that 30 or so years ago, the graft coming in to support political activities. As a young person, I had an interview with my precinct captain for a term paper in college. I was probably 17 years old. And, you know, he's explaining all this. He didn't care. But he made me laugh. He goes, you know that summer camp that I get you and your brother into? And it doesn't, because I came from a broken home. Your mother doesn't have to pay a dime. Where do you think the money comes from? It's the money the machine collects from God only knows who, and it's redistributed into the communities to support the elections. Votes were bought. I mean, there was a lot of charity that the machines actually practiced. And all they asked for is, you know, once a year or once every other year to vote the proper way. We always got food baskets, you know, from the precinct captain. They were like a social service agency in many communities that was not provided by government at that time, official government. So that was the machine. And Joe talks about it extensively in his book. And the interesting thing about the Jewish community is how involved they were. Maybe it's because their ethnic solidarity, but they built a powerful machine. And they used that graft money for things within their community as well.
Yeah, I want to go to Joe first, but you were mentioning the elections. I just want to read these two sentences from The Jungle about how the bosses controlled their districts. He writes, "On election day, all the powers of vice and crime were one power. The bosses could tell within 1% what the vote of their district would be, and they could change that vote in an hour's notice." So if they change their mind, they can make everyone vote one way or the other. But Joe, why don't you talk about the Jewish experience and the connection with the political machine?
Sure. If I can start a little bit further back with just the larger machinery of how corrupt they were. One of my favorite examples is there was, in fact, a Republican mayor in the era of Capone. Big Bill Thompson was his official mayor, as it were. And we know the mob was getting money directly to his election. It was understood the money flowed up. Thompson, of course, at the same time was a puppet to many of these guys. He had to answer to them in ways that subsequent mayors, I don't know Kelly's career as well, but by the time you get to the first mayor Daley, there's a whole different dynamic. The politicians have reasserted themselves in some important ways. But at one point, I believe when Thompson was elected mayor, he lost all but one ward. He lost all but one ward, but the plurality of the ward in the first ward, where all the corruption took place, was so dramatic that it overcame the vote count from across the city. So the gangsters were hugely influential in the way they were able to get politicians elected. And even into my era in the city, living in the 80s, there were aldermen who you could recognize were elected through this sort of series of grafts, and that, you know, that's where their influence was coming from. I mean, I love those stories Robert is telling about how, you know, just it was understood. This is, if you want a summer camp, if you want a gift basket, it's all going to come from them. In the Jewish space, it really was sort of remarkably well controlled. He was not always an alderman, but Jack Arvey was the most important politician to emerge from that area, and he was a literal kingmaker. In his capacity, basically as a West Side political figure, he helped elect Chicago mayors. He supposedly handpicked some of the candidates for Senate out of Illinois, and was legendarily influential in the selection of John F. Kennedy as a national candidate. Not John F. Kennedy, FDR, and a central figure in that particular larger coalition. Because the FDR coalition is, in many respects, a coalition of those communities that were excluded by prohibition. The Catholic JFK represented the Irish directly, but the Italians, the Jews, the Poles, others had said, why in the world would we ever think about outlawing alcohol? And it was that the coalition that formed around FDR was really born out of that sense that we're not being fully represented.
Yeah, so I think the point that I need to make about what Joe just said is the entire prohibition movement, which was an ongoing movement from the start, from the nation's founding, the temperance movement, always had a tinge of anti-new immigrant group to it. It was always a little bit waspish. It was the Irish were lazy, dirty drunks, and then the Italians were lazy, dirty drunks, and then the Jews were lazy, dirty drunks. But even all before then, the first Germans who settled in Chicago in the 1830s and 40s on Sundays would go for a walk and sit in the parks and drink their lager beer. And this was looked down upon too. And we remember the beer riots in, I think, the 1850s when the city tried first to ban the sale of alcohol on weekends, and the Irish and Germans did it. So prohibition was basically the political expression of a lot of anti-immigrant feeling. And I liked how Joe said FDR was kind of the president who started transforming that. But let's move on to a next, maybe one of our final points. I'd just like to get to more of the decline of this system. So we already mentioned that the sort of nature of organized crime started changing. And by the 50s, say, there was even less need for people within these organized crime institutions. What is it that's really changing the nature of organized crime from this connection between politicians and criminals to what we have today, which is basically street gangs? What are the main driving forces that are changing this? Is it just like the FBI is more effective at imprisoning gangsters or what? Robert?
Well, times have changed. Society is more modern. You have more educated people. Checks and balances have developed. Like you say, a more sophisticated federal government, Justice Department, the FBI. It took them quite a while to step up to the plate, but they finally did and learned how to use the RICO. But even by then, what was left of the mob had really been scaled down. Society is freer. You know, young people, I don't think necessarily frequent houses of prostitution. You know, you go to a nightclub, you buy some cocaine from some guy in the cloakroom and you party. Times have changed. Young people don't go to burlesque shows. I remember 17 years old, everybody in my neighborhood, it was a tradition. You went downtown to State Street to see the burlesque show because you can get in at 17. Those things all became passé. There was no need for them, so to speak. Society was far more open. Sexual mores were different. You didn't have to frequent a prostitute. Birth control became widely available. So times have changed. Society had changed. People became more sophisticated and lack of a need for an underworld.
Right. And the other thing I was thinking is the opening of Las Vegas, which drew a lot of, I know a lot of people, Italians from Cicero went to Vegas to work officially with official jobs. Mm-hmm. So the legalization of gambling and the creation of legalized gambling meant that people who had experience running gambling houses illegally, well, suddenly they were the experienced people who could spot card sharks and knew who the high rollers were and all of this stuff. So basically, you were doing the same job you always did illegally in Chicago, but you could start doing it legally in Vegas.
I'll add, if I can, the lottery was a really the Illinois State Lottery locally that undercut an awful lot of gambling. What we call policy, the numbers, all of those elements, that's a huge source of income to the mob that's gone.
Interesting. Okay, we're nearing the end of the podcast today. I wanted to give each of you an opportunity to tell a little Chicago-related mob story. Joe, I loved your first one. I'm certainly not going to be able to top that. I will say, though, that my grandmother taught Italian to the famous Vatican banker from Cicero by the name of Marcinkus, and he never would have become the Vatican banker had he not known Italian. So that's my one Chicago Cicero story with the outfit. I might tell you another one, though, too. One of my cousins opened up a restaurant in the 80s in the southwest side of Chicago. And he was selling one type of bread in his restaurant. And one day, two Goombas arrived and said, "You're going to be buying Ganella bread from now on." And so from that point on, no problem. He just changed his bread supplier. But this is an example of maybe some of the light racketeering, I guess it's heavy racketeering if you choose not to change your bread supplier. But certain industries were still controlled by the mob. So those are my two stories. Do you have any fun, more modern examples of outfit behavior, Joe or Robert?
Well, I could tell you all kinds of cute stories, but I'll give you one. As a teenager in high school, I worked in a supermarket. And it was owned by a whole bunch of old-time Italians one of them was my grandmother's cousin. So I worked there all through high school. And they grew up with Ross Prio, the boss of the North Side. So, I mean, we didn't have anything illegal going on, anything like that. Ross just loved to get his meat at the store. So he'd come in with his whole entourage with two other gangsters, you know, fancy hats, fedoras, and beautiful suits. And they buy their Italian sausage because they made like a special brand, so to speak. So one Christmas, I get called in by the boss, and there's 100 pounds of Italian sausage. And he says, here's the keys to my car. Here's 10 addresses. You take a 10-pound bag of sausage to each one of these houses, ring the doorbell, tell them that Ross sent you, and you give them the 10 pounds of Italian sausage. And I did. Quite an experience for a 17-year-old kid.
I'll say. Joe?
Well, Robert's a hero. These are the bad guys, and Robert fought against them. Me, I came along much later.
Not much.
And it was I came in terms of the people that I was working with and studying were from the 20s and the 30s primarily, and I was coming along in the 80s, 90s, and after that. So I had it far safer. My guys were all dead, but there was one particular gangster. I won't mention the name, and I was trying to uncover something about his history. I wanted to get his FBI file if possible. And in order to do that, I needed to get his date of death. And I was able to discover that he had died and he'd been buried in a particular cemetery in Chicago. And so I called the cemetery and said, you know, I'm interested. What can you tell me about this particular person? I need an absolute date of death. So I was on the phone. I heard the woman going through the file. She pulled up, I pictured kind of a dusty folder. She opened, she said, oh, she read the name. She says, yes, date of birth. And then before she could give me date of death, she said, oh, excuse me, there's a note here that says, do not give out any information under any circumstances on this person. And I could hear her kind of slap the folder closed and put it in a drawer. And I said to myself, better I should continue to stick with just the really dead gangsters rather than the ones who are still out there.
Yeah. Good story. So as we go now to the present, since 1975, over 30 Chicago aldermen have been imprisoned for corruption. And of course, 4 out of the last 11 governors of Illinois have been imprisoned for corruption. For the career police officer, I'll just ask you, that type of organized crime is gone. So do we just attribute more recent examples of political corruption and graft to some history in Chicago, something in the atmosphere that leads to corruption? Or is this just really individuals making their decisions to be greedy and corrupt? So how do we think of this today?
Well, today it's probably an individual. No, there is somewhat of, obviously, those in control of City Hall today have a large political organization, but it's somewhat different. I think that the days of mob-type crime, corruption, certainly are over. And you see the type of things that the federal government charges politicians with today. They're just not as fun, as exciting as what we saw in years gone by. I don't know. It's like, did they ever learn? You mentioned Blagojevich. Why the hell did they send him to jail? What did he do? I just don't understand it. He tried to sell Obama's Senate seat. How do you do that? Where's the crime?
that was the golden goose thing. Yeah. Now another story. Joe, this is another name that shall not be named, but I know someone who was given half the sentence in years that Blagojevich was given for a murder by hire plot. Blagojevich tried to sell Obama's Senate seat and got 14 years. Trying to get someone killed, though, only got someone else 7. So it seemed like, at the very least, a very strict penalty for not even trying to kill someone. But
what did he really do? It apparently nobody cared. Oh, well, finally he was pardoned. But there's days when I think we were better off with the old time guys. They had a sense of fairness. I don't know what the hell's going on today.
Joe, any final comments about the state of Chicago today?
Well, when I first moved to the city, my uncle used to say to me, he says, Joe, this is the name of this county isn't Cook County, it's Crook County. Somebody just stole the R, and so I think the sense of that there's been such a tradition of corruption and violence, the whole Chicago bang bang, that part of the charm of the city is our ability to remember these stories. They're not fun stories. And I really do mean it when I say someone like Robert is a hero. These are the bad guys. I don't want to celebrate them, but they're a huge part of the city. They shaped the city. Many people who were not really bad guys were allowed themselves to be brought into their midst and influenced by them. So it's an important part of the story that we tell as a city. And so I want to tell that story without celebrating them, just sort of acknowledging it's part of the weather, right? Part of the historical weather of this city, part of what shapes us. So I would want to end on that note. It's never about celebrating them and singing their praises, but I also think it's important not to forget them and remember that this is a part of what makes this city such an unusual and striking place.
Yeah, but it was more fun before.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much for sharing your expertise on the history of organized crime in Chicago. It was fantastic. And for everyone else out there, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americacentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americacentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americacentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americacentrum.de. Thanks for listening.